Welcome to the Disruptor Series podcast, where we listen to and learn from the people who are disrupting business, culture, and life. Here's your host, Rob Schwartz, CEO of TBWA Chi Day New York.
All right. Well, thank you for tuning in. I'm very excited. Our guest today is Jaron Lockhart. Jaron is an entrepreneur, a traveler, a photographer, a brand consultant, a storyteller, a fashion designer, and a problem solver. Jaron, welcome to the Disruptor Series podcast.
Hey, Rob. Nice to be here.
Now, I'm just going to let everybody know that this is going to be a great conversation, and you may not hear it because we are being infected by COVID-19 technical difficulties. So what's amazing is that Jaron has pierced pop culture. And what I didn't tell you up front is that she is the CEO and co-founder of the fashion brand Kanava. And over the last few weeks, Jaron and her team have created one of the most iconic and must-have items of COVID-19. And of course, I'm speaking of the Fauci underpants, or maybe I should call them the heroes of COVID-19 intimates. So Jaron, tell us about your famous underwear.
Yeah, I mean, we wanted to try to give back, and we had gone through a couple of rounds of more traditional, normal stuff, like getting people to buy, to donate to the LA Food Bank, and then we'd give them a gift certificate for product, or giving them information to hopefully aid in their lives. And then I posed the question to myself about how we could stay in the room as well as a brand. And then just honestly, as an entrepreneur and somebody who used to work in marketing more, I asked, you know, what do I want? Like, what do we have that we could do? And I was watching everybody just jones for Cuomo and then Newsom and then Fauci. And I thought, well, why don't we just, you know, it was part of our DNA. We had already started putting things on the underwear from the launch. And we decided that we wanted to try to have product as entertainment as a sort of part of our DNA. And thus they happened.
All right. So for those who have been under a rock and have not seen this, describe your underwear.
So we have a few different styles, and this was our sort of boy brief. And we went ahead and just tried to figure out, you know, remember like in, probably a lot of these listeners don't remember, but back in the day when you had to iron stuff on, or when you were, you know, joining a team. And so we looked at type fonts, and I come from a background of design, and we decided that we wanted to give somebody a way to sort of own something that they get, that they can sort of wear their pride with it. And then they could also give something back to a healthcare worker. So we're matching dollar for dollar, but we're not giving the healthcare workers underwear. We're going to give them other products.
All right. So what I've seen, so these are women's underwear. Yep. And on top of the front, you see either Cuomo's name or Fauci's name. Newsom was another one, right? For Gavin?
Yeah. Sort of like a basketball jersey, but the opposite.
And have you done any other sort of people of COVID on the underpants?
Or no, but we've gotten a million requests, right? So like Garcetti, because we're in LA. Don't forget the lesbians. What about Kamala? You know, just everybody that's in any sort of a political, Burks, what's her name? And we didn't want it to be political. We wanted it to be of the moment and to provide some joy and entertainment. But yeah, everybody's got an opinion for sure.
All right. So the idea was to give back. The way to get the give back going was you created this iconic underwear. And again, just explain a little bit more. So when people purchase the underwear, what happens?
So we're pooling together the same amount of money, and then we're going to donate products to teams that are on the front lines of New York and California, depending on which person you're supporting. Because we wanted to give them something to take home that was for them. That wasn't just food. There's tons of people working on that. And we wanted them to have something they could keep. So we're going to personalize product for them, send them robes. We're also, you know, we sort of started engaging in Palo Santo. We're going to talk to some other wellness companies, just so that those people who are just killing themselves to take care of other people have something, you know, sort of chic and current that's just for them.
So I think this is a fabulous idea. And you probably had a choice. You could have done a beanie. You could have done a t-shirt. Why did you pick underwear?
Well, I started this company literally like 8 weeks before COVID hit. I mean, we started it a year ago, but we launched 8 weeks before COVID hit. And I had been looking at this space for a really long time, and I knew there was a hole in the market for intimates. So it was one of the products we had already made. And I think it's cheeky and fun, and we want it to be fun. We didn't want it to be serious. We didn't want it. It wasn't contrived. It really, truly was like an idea one day at my dining room table while I'm locked up at my house in the Hollywood Hills, and I start bouncing it off my friends over text. And that's literally how it happened. It's just the same as, I guess, what you do, you know, sitting around a room bouncing ideas off each other.
Yeah, but you really, you know, you've got a hit in pop culture, which is so hard to do these days.
I mean, and I would love to tell you we tried. You know, I sent out an email to our email list and posted it on our social. We don't have a PR agency. We launched 8 weeks before COVID.
All right, so we're going to talk about Kanava and how you saw, you know, a way to disrupt what was going on in the fashion world. But before we get to that, again, I want to talk a little bit more about what happened. So you create the product, then what?
Literally, we send it out to our audience, and we just do a quick email, and we do some social on our really, really limited channels, and then I posted it on mine. And a journalist here in Los Angeles picked it up and wrote a story on her own sort of validation. Like, she didn't call us. She just ran a quick story. And then that quick story got picked up by, it's been syndicated now around the world.
All right, so now when you sent the first email out, you put the stuff on Instagram, how fast did the hit happen? I mean, did you know, like, after 10 minutes, we got a thing here?
No, so we posted the Cuomo, and that was about 2 weeks before. I don't know the exact date, and I should have gotten that for you. And we watched that, like, be light sales. It was cute. It was, like, it was more sales and attention than we'd been getting online to date, because we've been having a ton of great success in person. And then immediately, we were going to do Fauci and Newsom at the same time, and we decided, let's just test Cuomo, because we don't even know if anybody's paying attention. I've been having a real internal struggle around talking about product right now. We were brand new, and a big part of our philosophy is don't always talk to somebody when they're buying something from you anyways. So it was even harder now to be like, hi, we're new, buy something from us. So I think that's why we took a couple paths before this, and then to stay in the room, we decided to do Fauci and Newsom, and then that became the thing that was the trigger. Took 2 weeks, a little bit of sales, us adding on, because people asked, even though we had already planned. And that was enough to, like, sort of make it cement.
Amazing.
And then it was within, I sent the email within 4 hours. It was on LA Magazine.
Wow. Yeah. All right. So LA Magazine writes the first piece. And then, I mean, I saw it in the New York Post. I saw it TMZ.
Yeah. LA Magazine writes the first place. The second email comes from Fox News of all places. And I just look at my screen frozen. Like, what do I do with that? Next morning, we wake up to a story from Fox News that's a positively written story. I would say both of them, you know, maybe it's due to the information that's on our website or in the emails. I don't know how they got a hold of them, but they actually told the brand story and the story of the project. And it was kind of great to see that happen. And then from Fox, it syndicated in certain ways. TMZ contacted us. The New York Times ran it in their political newsletter a week later. The New York Post ran it. It ran in the Daily News yesterday in the UK. We got, you know, sort of syndication requests from those people that work with TMZ about photographs. Like, can we syndicate these photographs around the world, and people wanting to come film B-roll of us making the stuff? I mean, it's really interesting and fun. We're letting it be amazing is what I keep saying every day.
That is great. Let it be amazing. And I think that's really important, because I think a lot of us who work, you know, with brands, we try to control everything. We try to control every bit of the narrative. So it's interesting that you just are kind of, you know, riding the wave a bit.
Well, but I mean, there's a couple of things I used to say back when I was in the agency world and then in my last company. And even when I was an executive at J.Crew recently, you know, you only get 15 minutes to be super pissed off or super excited about anything, because the next thing's coming, right? And so this, I woke up that next day and I just was like, we're going to let this be amazing. This is different. Like, we're not going to try to control this. I can't control it. We didn't cause it. I mean, we caused it, but we didn't, you know, we hit a nerve. And it's really nice because for it differently with this company, because of all the stuff we'll eventually talk about, but because it has a mission behind it, it was so easy that any attention was good.
All right.
So you know, it's not like any press is good press, but like anyone who's looking at it is looking at what we're doing. So that's a win.
And all right. And I do want to get to the story. So just stay with us, because there's just a few more questions.
Yeah.
Any of these people who are on the underwear contacted you directly? Have you heard from the governor?
No, but I swear Cuomo has to have seen it by now with the New York Times and the New York Post. And Newsom, I mean, there's definitely connections through the world to Newsom here in California. I would be surprised, but nobody's contacted us.
Good. And then before we talk about the company, any thought about maybe designing a mask in the same style?
We definitely veered away from masks initially because there were so many people doing it. And we don't produce here in the U.S. currently. We produce near shore in Colombia. And they were sort of, there was a shutdown between the two. But we were looking at, it was funny, I was in the studio last week and we had a whole board that we'd done the week before of all of our future categories. And it was like men's, kids, home, travel. And I crossed out travel and wrote COVID. On the note, because right. I was like, we need to start thinking about that. So I think we will start to look at further ways to tell entertainment stories in products that are about the same price as a movie ticket, which is what this is.
That's great. All right. So let's talk about Kanava. And I think one of the things that's very interesting about this brand is what you call, and I'm quoting you, profit for purpose. So just tell us about this new brand you've created literally within the last 2 months.
Yeah, I mean, we launched it. We started incubating it last year, but we've just launched. I mean, I've spent so long between marketing and fashion, and I'd gotten a real wonderful window into sustainable production. And about 11 years ago, I started thinking about it. You know, just I'm curious. I ask a lot of questions. I'd seen a lot of the world. And I just, after the CEO left a crew and my team, the innovation group that I was running left as well, I decided that I was going to have this window of time where if I didn't do it now, I wouldn't do it. And I wanted to create a company that I wanted to buy stuff from. And I wanted to take the idea of impact and sustainability and social consciousness and community and just make it part of the DNA. Like, it is a brand that is a for-profit brand. We are not pretending like we're not. And we will, at the core of our DNA, have a purpose. And there's a few funnels that we put that into, but I think that if you know, obviously Patagonia is the benchmark, and without him doing what he's done for the last 20 years, this would be impossible. But we could tap into supply chains, and I just made the decision that it was gonna be as good as it could be at launch, and that it was more important to get to market because there's a hole in the category that we're in being caused by the fall of Victoria's Secret and others, and that I believe that consumers will care. Hmm. Like, some care now, but I think drastically even more care now than 8 weeks ago, which is kind of, we just sit here and go, wow, timing is really interesting every day.
Yeah, so this is really fascinating. So, you know, at least in our process, you know, we do these convention hunts, we look at different categories, you know, we look at, you know, different ways to look at the landscape. And it sounds like part of, you know, your breakthrough was, as you say, seeing the whole. I mean, maybe talk a little bit about how that happened.
So I started a brand in 2002 called Jaren Ford, which was meant to be a loungewear brand and an underwear brand. And it became a full-blown fashion brand that did runway shows and sold all over the world. So I've been looking at this space for a very long time. And part of it comes from my childhood. I grew up between New York and California. And in New York, when I was a kid, you couldn't wear sweats on the street. And there was no such thing as athleisure. So I had this crazy executive job in New York, and I was going to Parsons, and I would come home, and I just wanted something to wear to go across the street to the bodega, and there was nothing. So I made a pair of pants, and I built that company off of that. And when I got done with J. Crew, I had this on the list of brands to talk to them about, to this hole in the market, because there was just nowhere to buy something that had a good brand proposition that was made well, and I mean by that sustainable and ethical, but also designed well, like sexy and chic and fun without being hoochie. And I was watching the fall of Victoria's Secret. I also just, I'm pretty tuned into my own consumer behavior, and I look at it from a third, you know, perspective. And you ask anyone in the fashion business, and forever we were all wearing Gap underwear, and that was ridiculous. I was like, we're all wearing Celine and Gucci and Gap underwear.
Yeah, it's interesting because I guess people, you know, might take their intimates for granted. You know, they're, I don't know, it's...
It's an interesting segment. Like, there's a huge license business that runs a ton of it all over the world. And then there's these big players like Jockey and Hanes. And then there's a ton of little brands, but the value proposition isn't there. So having access to larger manufacturing processes, we just went in, and I knew that I also had the ability to invest in it, both with my time and with resources and my network.
Well, yeah.
So we had access.
I was going to say, I love this idea of kind of artisan underpants.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're making them in a small factory in Columbia. I went to Columbia because I was looking at that space for 5 years. They're really big and intimates. And I went to the country, and every one of the vendors we met with, every one of the factories had a social impact component built into their businesses. And this was in 2015. And I finally asked one of them why, and they said, because our government won't do it, we have to. So they were already a country built on community based out of necessity, primarily from the FARC war, not the drug war. And so we sort of tapped into that idea that they already had this in their DNA. So a lot of what we do from a perspective of innovation isn't the product necessarily, although we design a badass product and we do it in a way that costs you what it should. It's the model. It's how we look at how we bring that product to you and who we partner with to do it. Breaking rules without, I guess, breaking rules with a lot of education is what I would say.
And it seems like you're attracted to both the design parts of this business and the supply chain operations parts of this business, which I think makes, I don't know, it seems kind of unique. It seems like, you know, most people are either or.
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, design is solving problems, right? And you can't do that until you know what you're using to solve that problem. Like, define the problem. The problem is there's no narrative, emotional attachment to this sort of a product in the world that I have, and I know there's a huge space for it. And I had also been traveling the world for a decade and started asking questions about why, and thought there was this hunt for this experience that, you know, they'd sort of pegged on millennials, and maybe I'm a Gen X or living like a millennial, but I'd sort of fatigued of it, you know? And I thought, well, I feel like there's going to be this other experience happening, and it's going to be closer to home. And that was last May, a year ago. And I just felt like for this next brand, I wanted to focus on that moment where you're yourself, that thing that you put on when you feel that breath go out. And that was really the catalyst for it. And so how do we build a brand around that emotion? Because that was something that, like, with just the fatigue of digital and travel and the pace, and just, I have a lot of access to the wellness community as well over the last sort of decade. And it was an interesting way to sort of combine fashion and a true lifestyle without it being something that we're contriving, like the lifestyle that you want to live. And ideally this is something you can take anywhere with you, but not right now, just stay home with it.
It's cool. Kind of like wellness clothing. It's very interesting.
Yeah. And the brand is focused on making your life better.
So, all right. So you have this idea, you're seeing this hole in the market. What happens next? Does the name happen then?
So I wanted to fast track it because obviously I have a hybridized background, and I had just spent almost two years doing exactly this for the incubation or the innovation group that I was running at J. Crew. And the years before that I was consulting. And so I had been fast tracking businesses for people for a while. After doing my own, I sort of white labeled my processes. And we had access. I'd spent the last 5 years traveling around in factories and looking at sustainability charts and thinking about, I was starting a travel business and thinking about how travel and the truth of a place could impact people greatly. And I just sort of had a moment where I've got to bring it all together. And we had expertise. You know, I think part of the part of the way we fast tracked it is we are myself and my co-founder, who's a longtime colleague, we have multi-disciplines. So we just tackled it, and I have a great network. You know, I called on experts to do pieces. Mm. So the identity was done by somebody that you would know the identities that she's done, but we made it easy because I come from that world, and it was something that was fun. And she got to do a digitally native brand, but in a traditional way. And so I have a philosophy I call masking tape and caviar, which comes from my childhood.
All right, so we're going to get to unpacking that for a second. But basically, the process, though, you identified this white space. You see the hole.
Yep.
Then you look for people who can help fill this hole.
So I went around and I visited factories all over, specifically to tag on to everything. I called the experts that I know in the space. I targeted countries and ideals that we thought could build a full circle. Ideally, we're a completely circular brand, and ideally we're zero waste, but we're not, because that's not possible in the world. So I went to Spain and Portugal, and we didn't go to Morocco, but we have options there. India, we had connections with. Some of it we did by phone, and so we sampled with 6 different factories in 3 different countries.
Wow. So kind of a
simultaneously, without being wasteful, because it was small.
Yeah, but I think what's interesting is that there's a piece of this that is quite what's called intellectual, and there's a piece of this which is very tactical. You go to these places.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people dream, and maybe they have the idea, but they don't necessarily do the legwork, the literal legwork of going to these places. I mean, how much of seeing the factories, meeting the people, really affects how you're going to work with them?
I mean, it is the only thing. I mean, I had a clothing line for a decade. We produced in China because we were primarily a silk company, not because we were trying to get it done for cheaper, but silk is from China. And I will tell you, we worked at the factory for over a year and we could never, like, you know, because we are very intellectual, like, why is this happening? And I went to my first factory visit and I, like, just knowing where the tea room was changed things, seeing the sample room, and that changed it for me. And as the person who's writing the checks and as the person who's responsible, I said I would never do it again. And in order to do it again, I had to be able to see it. I think we're much more connected now because of technology. I mean, this was early in China where there was email, but there was no, you know, Zoom conferencing, and they weren't wearing Nikes or carrying smartphones back then. And I think that was a real lesson. And so I think the philosophy of the people that I was helping throughout the years in wellness and beauty and fashion, you know, I think you always want to know who you're working with, and human contact, showing up, like we show up. I think that's important.
Yeah. Yeah.
And also, there's cultural differences. Just how do you get to the airport? How far away from is the airport from the factory? I mean, all of that stuff can derail you. And what I think a lot of this is my own personal, I do have both the tactical side, the intellectual side, and the creative side, which is somewhat unusual. And I don't want to get distracted. So I like to perfect at least the knowledge to be able to problem solve strategically any part of it, so it doesn't derail our bigger mission.
Well, and tell me about what was your caviar theory?
Oh, masking tape and caviar. It's my creative philosophy. I mean, it has to come from my childhood. My father was a contemporary fine artist, or a modern fine artist, was before contemporary. And it's just that idea, like, how much modern art has masking tape in it? And I love the idea of things that are really luxurious and experiences that are refined, but I also love something that's completely crafted and sort of tactile. And I think that probably, you can probably see that in Kanaba. Like, it's meant to be an accessible luxury brand. By definition, the thinking is the same, or the people working on it might be also working on luxury brands, but then it's meant to be something that actually works in your life. And that would be the masking tape part.
Love that. I love that balance of high, low. And then the name Kanaba, is there any magic to that?
Yeah. So Kanaba, I was walking down the street in Spain and I saw it on the side of a building. I have no idea what it means. I was with a friend who's fluent in Spanish and she's like, it means nothing. I looked it up and we were in the process. I have a few other names that I have held for other things. We were working on the product development and the raw material development. And I started looking at it and it didn't really mean anything. It's a Catalan word that doesn't mean much. And I thought, well, we didn't know what Google meant before Google meant what it does. And that feels like marketing gold or branding gold to me. And I was with one of my friend's husband is a banker and he was with us and he was like, that doesn't mean anything. I don't understand what it means. And I was like, exactly. Thank you. Yes.
Right.
And I had just finished working at J.Crew where we were trying to globally trademark names for things I was creating.
Right.
And that was just like, you know, on top of my past trademark experience and naming, I have a whole naming cadence game that I play. And this had nothing to do with it. This was walking down the street. There's a sign on the side of a building.
Wow.
Hopefully it means nothing.
And I guess one of the great things about a name without meaning is that you will give it the meaning.
Yep. And so now we're like, how do you Kanaba? What is your Kanaba? And I think that's that idea around that feeling of authenticity and being true to yourself. Like, it's that moment where you don't have to fight the world. You know, there's just everything is right. And that can be like really good food or, and I think we're taking that thinking and putting it into the product, how we choose every detail.
Yeah, it's kind of like a Zen moment, a moment. Interesting. All right. Now, you've said, I mean, just so many incredible things, and you've really had kind of an amazing career. So let's talk a little bit about your journey. I mean, you're here now. You're doing something amazing. Where the hell did this all start?
The zigzag of my life. I will say I never did anything twice, I don't think, except for maybe this. You know, I think for me, there's a few things that are really pivotal. One was my parents were not rich by any means, but my trust fund was a cultural one. My dad lived in Soho and his friends were artists that, you know, some of them, you know, and some of them you don't. And that gift was priceless. Having New York every summer and holiday during the 70s and 80s as a kid that was curious on their own, because I was an only child. That was the first gift and really taught me a bigger world, I guess. You know, I can thank all of them for that. They were breaking the rules. You know, I call them cultural immigrants, where they did the same work that an immigrant would do traveling 7,000 miles to sort of fight whatever the expectations were. So I grew up in a bubble of anything's possible. I never questioned being a girl or not being rich, or I just never thought about it because of the way I was raised in between California and New York. And then I think secondarily, funny enough, was my accidental career in advertising. My father worked on sets as a kid, and I remember being on a set. It was a windy set, and he was the dolly grip because he did that also. And I went to visit him, and there was Evian and director's chairs. And I was like, who are those people? And he was like, oh, those are the agency people. And I was like, yeah, you're pushing a thing, and they're drinking Evian. It was in a loft in Tribeca. And, you know, my dad was golfing with Dave from Wendy's the next day, because that's the kind of guy that he was. But that sort of started it. And then my high school boyfriend ended up being an art director, random, moved to LA. And I ended up in advertising while I was in college. And I think that process of being an art buyer and then a producer and being the person who facilitated creative ideas was something that was really interesting to me. I had never, like, my parents expected me to be a creative. And I didn't have that same expectation. I was like the Alex P. Keaton of my family. I mean, let's just tell a quick personal story. At 13, I wrote down everything that had to happen in my house in the morning before I went to school, which room it happened in and how long it took. I put them in order so I could sleep longer. Like, that's who I am in my DNA. So Shiat and my time there as a producer and an art buyer, and then beyond that as a director's rep and stuff, was just all systems. And I also think it's about authenticity. I mean, it was a specific time there. Mm. We were changing the world in the same way that I thought my dad's friends were changing the world in New York. Like, every day could be the last, and every day we could make anything happen. And it really, truly felt like that. I mean, I know it sounds culty, but that's the reality.
Well, so what happens after you leave advertising? Because I remember...
So I'm still in advertising when I start my first company. So I'm an executive on the production company side, and I start a company, and I would go downtown at like 7 in the morning and deal with production, and then go do an executive job, and then do that at night. And, you know, there was a few benchmarks that I'd set. It hit that, and my contract was up for renewal. And I was all quite young still then. I was in my early 20s when I worked at Shiat. And by this time, I'm not even 30. And I went into the executive producer of the company, and I said, I think this might be my 15 minutes, and I have to go try, right? So I went, and I was a stylist. And then I had a brand for a decade at a really specific time.
Right.
Not dissimilar to this, I have to be honest, where I had an idea. I wanted it to solve a problem. It was more like a direct-to-consumer brand. And right. I leveraged the community around me, just like you would starting a small business 100 years ago. And it turned into something else because the industry changed around it. Mm. And I rode the wave.
But that moment, I guess, of being a stylist, had you been interested in clothing before then, or that awakened something in you?
No. So my mom was a costume designer, and my grandma and my mom taught me to sew when I was 6. My walls were papered with Ralph Lauren and Calvin Klein ads when I was a kid. But I never thought about going into fashion because I watched all the creative people around me have a hard, challenging time. And I had a job that was so like overwhelming that I didn't end up finishing college because it was so great. And it was one that like 20 people in the world had. And I thought, well, this is happening now. I can always go back to school. So I would love to, and I did always plan on starting something. So Jaren Ford was a creative project, the same as Kanava. They are artistically based in their process, even though they're commerce focused companies.
All right. So when you had your stylist moment, did you then go back to fashion school, or where?
So I was at Parsons when I was an executive in New York. 9/11 happened, and the day before at 10 p.m. I'd agreed to move back to L.A. So I came back to L.A. I sort of finished fashion school and started the company, and again didn't finish college because I'd started something. And then I went to be a stylist after being an executive in production because it was something I could do that was related to fashion, and I could do it in time. Like, I could do it at the same time. So I did love it. I primarily worked with people I knew. Mm. And then I funded the company doing that, originally the first one. And it just became too busy. I couldn't do it anymore. The company started to take off. And then that company happened. And then, you know, the recession happened. And we lasted another 3 years. I wasn't super excited about the model of fashion that's now crumbling. And I decided to shutter the brand and figure out what was next. And I really thought I was going to stay in travel. I really did. I was like, you know, I was like, travel, fashion, art. Art's really hard and siloed. Fashion I've already done. Travel seems like this wide open space. And so I'd been working on that for a few years while I was consulting as a problem solver and a fixer, basically, either C-suite or sort of helping people incubate businesses for 5 years, actually, traveling the world and basing out of LA. But sort of doing what we're all doing now.
Well, I just remember seeing you on social media with this phrase, Born Packed.
Yes.
So was this like a project? I mean, how would you describe that?
So I sat in a house in London, a fashion photographer and I changed houses, just like that movie. She was British and I was American. And I was in her basement kitchen, which was beautiful. And I was like art, fashion, travel. And I came up with Born Packed there. And it was based off my childhood because what I had seen and the way I'd always advised people when they were going to a place. And I think you know this from advertising. We had a very privileged experience where we would go to places. And I started in print where that was, back in the day, a very long process. So we would go somewhere like Chicago for a month, you know, and then I'd call my friends or I'd end up for 3 months in Buenos Aires, you know, and you just, it's very much like the life my father and his friends lived as artists, but with the privilege of work attached to it and access, right? So we always were working with locals and I coined it Born Packed and it then turned into a business. And we were working on it. We were in the process of getting it funded. We were taking meetings. I brought on two co-founders and then we got a project for it from West Elm, which Jim Brett, who was the one who ran fashion for Urban Outfitters when Jaron Ford did a big collaboration with them. And I just sort of stayed in touch with him. I respected what he was doing. I'd have dinner with him and his husband. It was very casual and just more of a mutual respect from a professional level. And then I ended up consulting at West Elm and we produced a bunch of films for Born Packed, which was meant to be a hybridized media product platform. Specifically looking at how you authentically create true branded content and how do you partner with brands to do that without, you know, brands want access to your audience, audiences want access to brands, countries want access to brands. And I sort of built this global map of how we could create a very efficient sort of future thinking media company that could give back, but that could also, because there's no better way to give back than to make something somewhere and to tell the story of how you did it, right? Because you're bringing eyeballs to the art or the artisan or the craft or the raw material. And then can you do that with Toyota Prius? Or in this case, it ended up being West Elm. And we got very lucky. We did a year's worth of films with them that we're really proud of. And then I was literally at home 2 weeks from starting to distribute our first Born Packed films that were our own that we had shot. We were getting ready to go edit them. And Jim took the job as the CEO of J. Crew, and I had been spewing information for 5 years about how if I ever got an opportunity that was that big in the fashion space where I could use all of my experience and access to make a difference, I would. And so I went and said yes. I'd interviewed for a couple of other positions like that, and they were never innovative. You know, it's a hard thing in fashion to innovate. While Google has an innovation tank, or, you know, every pharmaceutical company does, or even like Kraft Foods might, or, you know, S.E. Johnson, it just doesn't exist in the fashion business. It's a weird, siloed, secret business. And so I thought, well, this is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. And I basically took the toolkit of an entrepreneur, the network that I had, and the access that we had, and we went to go try to transform a big company by using existing assets and to tap into exactly what we're talking about today, which is what's missing in the market.
Well, I love your idea of, you know, finding a, like an innovation laboratory in the fashion world, because you're right. I mean, apart from, I guess, Galliano on the runway, you know, where is innovation, you know?
I mean, Uniqlo does development with, like, innovation within fabrics. I mean, there's innovation in fabrics. There just isn't, the margins aren't there. It's a business sort of, I don't know, it's an interesting business. It's part of why I stepped away from it in the beginning, like in 2012. I just didn't see, I didn't feel like the people selling stuff to people cared about the people.
Yeah, interesting.
And a lot of it's just hierarchical and it's built in from the hundreds of years of how that, plus right. It's a business that people can do. Like, you could go do it if you know how to sew. Mm-hmm. So the barrier to entry is lower than some other industries. And so there's just this, I don't know how to explain it, but I'm watching it crumble right now. And it's nice to see the rejiggering of it because I think it will benefit consumers and the people who make products.
And then, and it seems like, you know, you mentioned Change the World in a couple of your, you know, stops in your career. I mean, was part of your frustration there that they weren't changing the world? They were just, you know, trying to turn the next season.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I think it was 2000, gosh, it was at least 11 years ago. There's a group called Yossi, which was a social innovation company that I was connected to. And we hosted a challenge to fashion. And it was funny. It came about from me talking to a very innovative woman who owns it, where I said, you know, think about like a hanger in fashion. There's like six hangers that your garment could be on before it gets to the store. And you don't know that. And PS, hangers need to be designed by industrial designers or somebody at MIT, not someone from FIT or Parsons. Like, that's just not the way it should work. And the business just wasn't centralized. You know, I think there wasn't a lot of VC money going to it. The private equity money was going to the large retailers. To get something funded was, you know, sort of almost impossible. I think a lot of it was that. And I do think that I walked away because even after, I kept just trying to reiterate, like, how do we reach an audience through media? How do we do good? And I just couldn't, I kept hitting walls. And I did, I had a call one morning in my backyard where it was like 4 o'clock in the morning because it was the only time China and America and Italy were open because we would take Italian fabrics and move them to China. And I just thought, I don't want to do this anymore for somebody I don't want to have breakfast or lunch with. And I think the quality of people I worked with in advertising, I got very lucky by where I worked and the specific time I worked there and our clients. They were amazing, even when we wanted to kill them. They still were people that you wanted to have dinner with, right? And I found in fashion that was much fewer and further between for me. But it's different now. It's changing. It's consolidating. And a lot of that sort of flash of the perception of fashion, like you said earlier, is dissipating.
And you know,
I don't consider us in fashion, by the way, either. We're in product.
Well, that's interesting. You know, and as I hear, you know, your stories and knowing you, I mean, this will be like kind of an odd question, but how is it that you are so fearless? I mean, you tell me some stuff. You're like, well, I just, you know, started this company because I, you know, saw this hole in the market and boom, I had to travel to Morocco. I mean, how is it possible? You just do this stuff. You felt like, you know, no fear.
I mean, I think there's tons of fear, but I don't give into it. And a lot of it is my childhood. It's because every summer I left and I didn't even know what they were doing. Like, I don't think my parents knew. They were 20 and 21 when they had me. They couldn't possibly have. They just didn't fuck me up. You know what I mean? That's what happened. And I got to go see this world and I was forced to be empathetic. They were hippies. My name is Jaren. Like, let's just start there, right? But they weren't like the kind of hippies that were like dancing drugged out. They were like social hippies. They were about reading and philosophy and sort of, my father was super into Ireland and super into poetry. And, you know, they wanted to change the world. They were part of that generation that was about civil rights and all of that. And so there was just never an option not to do that. And I think you learn when, like, my father passed away when I was young. And also, they just live their life this way. There's no guarantee of tomorrow. Mm. And I think every time I get scared, like, I remember when I first started traveling, I remember getting my driver's license was like, that seemed like a catch-22. You don't know how to drive, but you need to know how to drive to get the license. But I was like, I don't know how to do this. This is crazy. And then I got to the place where I was driving in places like Paris and Bali and craziness. And I remember the first time I was like terrified. I was like, there are people here in this country who aren't as smart as you, who aren't as clever as you, who figure it out every day. So just shut up and do it. And so I have these like weird self-management tools that I use.
Amazing.
And I guess that's the answer. I look at if somebody, once you know how somebody did something, like just listen to Richard Branson's books. And then how could you not try?
Yeah. I was just listening to something about, I think at the age of 27, he went to Boeing and said, hey, I'd like to borrow one of these planes.
Yeah.
27, just the gumption of that, because I'm going to show you guys how you can, you know, have more control of your pricing, because right now there's only one airline in Britain, which is British Air. So let's start another one. 27.
Yeah. I mean, I think you have to be willing to fail and you have to not care what other people think. And I think for me, that came from my childhood. My parents were divorced when a lot of people were still married. I left every summer, so I didn't have a summer experience with my friends. My name was weird.
Yeah.
I didn't look like everybody else. Like, even though I'm super not ethnic in reality to the world, compared to like a bunch of blonde-haired, blue-eyed people in Northern California, I'm ethnic. And I don't have siblings, and so I'm having this singular experience. I think you just have to either lean into it. I always say I was the right kid for that experience, I guess.
That's great. All right, well, this is the part of the show where you offer up one piece of advice. And I think, my God, this episode, there's so many things that a person could grab onto. But, you know, we have CMOs, we have rising stars in the business. Maybe give someone a piece of advice on, because I like your thing where you had a little side hustle and it opened you up. If somebody's got an idea for a business, what should they do? What's the Jaren Lockhart way?
So number one, I would say respect your fear and acknowledge it, but don't let it slow you or stop you. because that whole idea of imposter syndrome or whatever you want to call it, once you start to solve how things happen, your fear becomes manageable. And the fear of, what is the worst case scenario? Like, I used to run worst case scenarios. Like, if I'm homeless, I could get a gym membership and take a shower there. Like, as an entrepreneur, you do that shit in your head. And then I think, for me, because my childhood was so different, and it really does play into everything. Every one of these experiences I've looked up and thought, oh my God, everything I've ever done every day led me here, right? And it keeps happening. So when I went to J. Crew, everyone around me was like, oh my God, everything you've ever done has led you to this. So that ends in like a ball of fire when Jim leaves. I have a break and then I start this and I think, oh my God, everything I've ever done has led me to this. Like, I think that's be authentic and show up, respect your fear. And then also, what is the Chiat Day thing? If you don't bother coming in on Saturday, don't come in on Sunday.
Yep.
As an entrepreneur, you work for yourself. So you can decide, I missed a lot of dinners and I missed other things, but I think it was worth it.
Yeah. Amazing. Well, Jaron, you are an inspiration. Holy smoke. So thank you for being on the show. And I'm very excited about your underpants. I think it's not easy to get someone's attention. So that's great news.
Thank you so much. I think we're just letting it be amazing and then moving on to what we were already doing.
And that's it. Let it be amazing. I think we're going to leave it at that. I think that is the best phrase I've heard in the last couple of months. Let it be amazing. So thank you, Jaron.
Thanks a lot.
You've been listening to the Disruptor Series podcast brought to you by TBWA Chiat Day New York. Craving more disruption? Visit us at TBWAChiatDayNY.com.